Harry Constable in his own words. Episode 8, Years of Turbulence. 1945 saw the beginning of what was to be years of dock turbulence and struggles against the ship owners and dock authorities. With the return of peacetime production, the dock's employers were preparing to take advantage of a growth in trade by increasing the exploitation of their labour force. They planned to weaken the unions and make labour more flexible. However, among the dockers, as among the majority of workers, particularly those in the army, there was a general feeling that there would be no return to the 30s and the conditions that had existed before the war. The scene was therefore set for a stormy struggle in the docks.
In these decades following the Second World War, when the dockers went on strike, the Daily Mirror and other papers called us lazy dockers. They built up in the minds of the public the fiction that port workers were unskilled dock labourers and troublemakers. There were many thousands of people who had a different opinion, who respected the docker for his fighting ability against the dock's employers with their terrible record. The impression put about was that all dockers had to do was to load the ship so that it sailed safely out of port, or discharge the ship in the safest possible way, that it wasn't highly sophisticated work.
As time went by, more scientific methods of loading and discharging were used. This called for a higher awareness by the port worker, and it called for a lot of skill, knowledge and experience. Almost anything you care to think of was stowed or discharged by the docker. Now, this was not just a case of sending the crane or the winch down the hold to pick up the cargoes, or of the men just putting them on slings and boards. It was much more complicated than that.
Through the press, all the general public knew was that cargoes went down the ship's hold, were stowed away, and beams and hatches were put on. But at the time I speak about, the cargoes were very varied, from bones being imported from Argentina after the cattle had been slaughtered on the ranges, to cargoes such as a train and its tender having to go into the ship's hold, or maybe a luxury yacht put on as deck cargo. There were cargoes of horses. They used to be shipped fairly regularly. Nowadays, they can be carted by aircraft much quicker and at less risk to the animals. Frequently, the docker ran across an almost insurmountable object, or maybe he'd got to stow or discharge a cargo that caused many complications. Now, it was his job to solve the problem. It was his job, nobody else's. Whether he was working day work or piecework, whatever the job called for. A good illustration of the skills of the docker was when they brought troops into the dock to discharge or load cargoes. The injury rate went up immediately and there was chaos. It was not organised loading and discharging that was done by troops, although the press would try to make you believe this was so. We heard many things when there had been a large strike and the troops had been brought in, and we felt very sorry for them.
During the Second World War, the government had introduced a smoother, more efficient organisation on the docks, forming the Dock Corporation in 1940. The new corporation was controlled by the employers, the union and the state. Port workers continued with the established custom of going to call points for employment, then to the different ships or warehouses. Those men not hired went to the corporation port office, where they would hand over their registration books to the port manager or his assistant. They would then be allocated to employers.
Under the corporation, for the first time, every man became a registered port worker. But if the board saw fit, they could withdraw a docker's registration, leaving him without his livelihood. When I started again on the docks after my discharge from the armed forces, I had forgotten about the toilets. They were an outstanding shock compared to what I had been used to, even in my war service. I was soon to learn that what my older brothers had told me was true. These bad conditions had continued for years, and protests fell on stony ground.
With the war in Europe finished, the dock employers went on the attack. At Surrey Docks, on the south side of the Thames, They cancelled all war bonuses and proposed a revision of rates set far below what they had originally been. The men refused to have the conditions imposed on them and in retaliation went on a go-slow protest. The employers countered the go-slow with an announcement that 1,500 men were locked out.
The Transport and General Workers Union leadership acted quickly and condemned their own members who were trying to safeguard their living conditions. In answer to this, unofficial port workers' committees were hurriedly set up and the dockers in London reacted with strike action. Fresh from the war, the port workers were in no mood for subservience to anyone, not even to the union they had helped establish, which over the years had become wealthy and moribund with a firmly entrenched bureaucracy. On 24th of July 1945, Churchill had put hundreds of troops on standby so they could be used as strike breakers.
On the 25th of July, a Labour government was elected. It lost no time in condemning the dockers out of hand and sent in the troops. There was immediate opposition nationally, and fraternal delegates were exchanged throughout all the ports up and down the country.
The National Unofficial Port Workers Committee had been established. This was always a very difficult time, trying to make contact with people you'd never met before, in a port you'd never been to before, and you didn't know really what you were in for either. They might be hostile, but okay, you have to take that in the struggle to build an organisation. We had a mixture of success and failure. In Avonmouth, Bristol and Portishead Docks, a mass gathering of 1,200 men voted 100% to back us. This was despite obstacles being shoved in our way by the police who marched us off the premises and the post office who held up our telegrams to the London committee for 2 days. Then we went on to Cardiff. Handbills were printed and distributed among the Cardiff dockers, but it was very, very difficult. We couldn't make contacts, so we put up at a hotel. In the morning, we came down quite early and we saw a policeman looking through the registration book where we put our names the night before. He made out that he didn't see us and we just walked past him. We felt that somebody must have phoned the police and said that these two dissidents, these two blokes from London, were staying there. It was all over the newspapers, two Londoners trying to pull out the Cardiff men. That night time, we put up in a boarding house. It was hilarious, really, because we had to listen to the wireless where they said that agents from the Port Workers Committee in London had been to Avonmouth and Bristol. Now they were in Cardiff, trying to incite mutiny and God knows what. There were people sitting around the table, discussing these two men, and we were tut-tutting. One of them, quite a big Welshman, said he felt it was his duty to wring their bloody necks. He wasn't a very left-wing Welshman at all.
After the strike, a Dockers' Charter was adopted by a National Delegate Conference of Dockers' Unions and thus became official policy. The 5 points of the Charter were a 40-hour week, a fortnight's paid holiday, a pension scheme for aged and infirm dockers, welfare service in all ports, and a daily minimum of 25 shillings. This last demand was an increase on the basic wage from 16 shillings. Dockers had received no increase in pay since 1922. As for pensions, well, there were still any amount of old people trying to earn a living on the docks.
One instance, when we were sent by bus to West India Docks, we had to show our union cards. One man said, "I'm 80 years of age and you want to look at my card?" The strength of feeling for change was shown in the fact that, at the height of the strike, over 45,000 port workers were on strike in the docks of Britain. The government, for their part, had deployed 21,000 troops.
If Paddy don't go, then I don't go. If Paddy don't go, then I don't go. If Harry don't go, then I don't go. The docks were at a standstill. If Paddy don't go, then I don't go. If Harry don't go, then I don't go. If Harry don't go, then
Harry
I
Constable,
don't go.
In his own words, as told to Bill Hunter, was read by Christopher Eccleston and Ethna Brown.